All right, I guess we're ready to get started then. All right, so first some announcements. For any of you who are interested, the DVDs are on sale on All Talks downtown. Yeah, downtown's cool, right? In the area over here on the 18th floor. And Robert Stick's books are on sale at the DVD store until his Spy Improv talk. All right, I haven't been getting a lot of sleep for the past few days, so bear with me. All right, so today I'm here to talk with everybody about the human brain and ultimately the hackability of that system. To me, this topic is interesting for, you know, a number of reasons, but among those reasons is the possibilities for all hackers of all types. Stereotypically, hackers have been known as people with good technical skills, but also as antisocial and not always with great social skills. And this obviously is not always true, but it would be interesting to see if at some point in the future a hacker became known stereotypically as a person who instead had very good interpersonal skills and a deep insight to what makes people tick. Of course, the most important thing of investigating these possibilities is to learn how to protect yourself. So, brain hacking in one form or another has existed for quite a while. The most broad of them is social engineering, which most of you are probably already aware of. And by taking a somewhat modern understanding of the brain into account with a programmer's perception of things, new possibilities seem to open up, allowing somebody not only to manipulate people with a battle of wits, but also by virtue of having an understanding of how they think. But anyway, first thing to talk about is the system that you'd be working with, which is the human brain. Basically functions as the central processing system of the whole nervous system, and it's the most complex and powerful computer known. But even with that impressive resume, it still has a number of notable issues. It's actually somewhat slow, compensating for that with massive parallelism. And it has a wide number of malfunctions that can either you're either born with or you develop as with age. And what's of particular interest is that the brain is the result of newer structures being built on top of older ones in the relatively random process of evolution. And just like certain operating systems, not really naming any names, and other systems for that matter, when built up in such a manner, have a number of issues and bugs which can arise. And if you look hard enough, you just might find certain ways to circumvent the system's securities and gain access to one of its systems which have a weaker. In the case of the human brain, this can't be good. So let's start by looking at one of the most classic forms of influence. Hypnosis. We've all heard about it, but I'm not talking about that stage stuff. Generally, when you hear about hypnosis, you'd hear about it being described as a sleep-like state, where the person is in a more suggestible state than usual. However, there are many kinds and of different depths. But no matter what kind, the most important piece of that equation is what's known as the critical factor. Hypnosis actually can be defined as bypassing the critical factor of the conscious mind followed by a selective acceptable suggestion. The critical factor is the protection for the mind. Basically, deciding what should or should not be believed. In short, it's a trust level, or a permission level, if you will. And there are, which would basically be, is someone taking what they're hearing with a grain of salt, throwing it all out the window, or absorbing every word they hear. This factor varies depending on a number of variables. For instance, if you if somebody came up to you in the train you'd not be very likely to believe them, anything they have to say. But you'd be less critical of what your best friend from kindergarten had to say. And it gets more complicated than that in the fact of it's not just who says things, but what you say. If I were to say tomorrow that the world's going to end in 4 years, most of you would probably be saying, oh boy, it's another one of them. But if I said the weather is going to be nice tomorrow, you'd be less likely to not believe what I have to say unless you heard something directly contradicting what I said, which illustrates the varying critical factor. And since the depths of hypnosis are contingent on the critical factor, this explains why there'd be different depths to that. And that in one sense you could say we're all already, always under some state of hypnosis. So the amount by which you decrease someone's critical factor towards what you say, the more influence you'll have over that person. And since different types of comments have different permissions enacted on them, you can use things that have lower permissions to escalate your permission level. And one of the ways you can do that is simply speaking, or more specifically, how you speak. There are a number of things that go into it. It's not just stringing words together in compliance with grammatical rules. Where you place things in a sentence as well as within the entire paragraph will influence the person's perspective on a phrase. And after the context does tell us how we're supposed to understand something that we hear. So when anyone speaks, there's a number of qualities about how they say things and the tone of voice, the inflection, accent, and so on. These also move throughout the entire sentence and the paragraph. Some of these affect how a person speaks. Some of these effects how a person speaks are obvious. For instance, if a professor with a monotone voice were speaking in front of a class, he'd probably put half his class to sleep. I've gone through that. However, there are also lots of less obvious known effects. Done right, you can draw emphasis to words or phrases and take attention off particular words. Remember, our minds pick up on lots of things, and whether you're conscious of it or not. So if you draw emphasis to away from particular words in a carefully placed sentence, you can make it so they barely notice a word while still conveying a meaning that would be interpreted as if the word was drawn into focus. Also, carefully choosing words can make use of what's sometimes called weasel words. By using words that have common meanings as well as other additional meanings, you can construct a sentence that syntactically has multiple meanings, or a hidden meaning within the Trojan horse sentence. For lack of a better term, but the brain has to go through all these to figure out which one's the proper one, so it still does run through each of the possibilities and subconsciously you remember them. It's important to note here, though, that the social conditions influence the various meanings of vocal patterns and phrases. And while many of them do have similar meanings in various situations, you would need to learn how to recognize those personality types. And on the topic of personality types, there are certain personality qualities that commonly appear together, which can be grouped into specific personality types or families. Cultures, subcultures, and likely genetic predispositions play an important role in shaping the various personality types. Understanding these types lets you understand a person's perception of things, such as their interpretation of vocal patterns and words and phrases and gestures. Equally important is understanding any of the personality types and by understanding them well enough, you can recognize outward signs and possibly allowing you to fingerprint the personality, either passively if they give out enough information about themselves or actively by probing with inconspicuous comments. In a sense, you can probe someone to attempt to discover their OS. It's not necessary to have a full fingerprint of a person's personality. You can easily hack a person with only a partial fingerprint, narrowing it down to the personality family that can reveal enough exploitable details about that person. And in today's day and age, even less will do, because with things like MySpace and Facebook and all other social networking sites, all you need is one little piece of information and you're led to a whole wealth of knowledge about that person where they tell you everything about themselves. The less questions you need to ask. And now that I've spoken about personality types, here's a little bit of something about what influences your personalities as well as what broadcasts. Mnemonics, or memes for short, is a concept called many things. Sometimes you may have heard it called social genes or thought viruses. Memes are thought to be blocks of social information that get transmitted through social interactions on the unconscious levels. It would seem that memes play an important role in making sure that members of society stick to the general beliefs of everyone around them. And body language also conveys a number of personal qualities as well as the person's mood. This, too, is also not conscious, or less conscious. And even though more is known about the body language in the general knowledge, there's still lots of things that are less well known. For instance, microexpressions. You may be interested to know that people don't have as much control over their facial expressions as most people would like to think. A lot of times, other expressions are simply being suppressed within a few fractions of a second. These expressions, these microexpressions, can actually reveal something about what the person may be trying to hide. For instance, if a person is lying, they'll probably make a microexpression, and if you were to take a still shot camera and freeze the moment when you show that, you'd likely see an image of disgust on their face. And with enough practice, most people can actually see these without using cameras. So by looking at these microexpressions and other more commonly known body language patterns, you're able to pick out some useful information in an attempt to possibly fingerprint a person's personality. And body language is not only just a tool of exploitation, but also of discovering. I mean, backwards. It's also a tool of exploitation and not just discovery. There's a number of things that you can do that can slip past the conscious defenses. For instance, during a conversation, it's not uncommon to see people moving their hands while they speak. And that gives you the opportunity to sneak in gestures that are barely noticeable unless you're looking for them. But the subconscious level did notice, and it's always recorded. And one of the most things you could talk about after am I going out of that? Yeah. But anyway, one of the most things I could talk about after disclosing any definite or possible security vulnerabilities is to mention the fact that this people need to look more into these kinds of things because more attention is being drawn to this. And while if you look on the internet, you won't see very much about these topics. You will see more than you see maybe 5 years ago. And you don't want to have just a few people learning how to control some of the most intimate details and not know how to stop it, or because you may possibly be able to patch the mind. And let's see. So, other things to talk about is that anchoring. You can, when you are doing anything, say you're saying a certain word, you can make a certain gesture and attach that idea that's conveyed in the words with that gesture. And if you condition the person, if you do it a couple of times, depending on how influenceable the person is, simply making that gesture will recall that feeling or whatever thought it is you were trying to convey. Unfortunately, I don't have much to say. If anyone needs to ask any questions, I am.
Can you talk at all about tryptamines or indole compounds? Talk about programming your mind.
Ah. That would be what I would call the local exploitation. Because with a lot of drugs, you're imitating chemicals that are already in your brain. So it's like taking an input and feeding it a kind of data which it believes is the proper and legitimate. And in reality, it's not. And you can then supply it in much larger quantities than your brain would normally provide, causing a much more intense effect. And people can use that, people trying to find truth serums and such. But as far as I know, that it varies depending on the person and not always the most dependable.
There's a characteristic called charisma, where people have this emotional tendency to start mimicking some of your neuro-linguistic patterns. For example, if you talk about things that are physical, grasping, visual, and whether you actually feel something, sense something, or you use the word grasp. All these words have tangible aspects of how you actually function. When you do that, the sociopaths pick up on it, repeat it, talk to these same patterns, you get this comfort level of patterns. And the thing is, as soon as you start talking about brain chemicals, the first thing you're looking at is your comfortability. When you start developing that comfortability, you're actually inside your brain have all the chemicals in the position where you are addicted to. This is part of a cultural programming set. You get dynamics of personality. They are an emotional framework. If you look and I learned about the brain, you have a certain type of enthusiasm. And it's enthusiasm that actually charges your brain to actually help focus the thing. If you're getting into a new study, what makes it easy? We get enthusiastic about a particular new study. And in every new study, we have a different type of charge enthusiasm. What it does is it charges our brain, it charges our physiology. And when it does, it creates an emotional complex. And that emotional complex actually has this energetic charge. It also does, feed your brain all these chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a dynamic, and it's a personality. And you can collect faculties. Unfortunately, what makes us also socially unconventional is our brains, when we act that way, we develop a personality that doesn't fit within the prescribed personality framework of society. Those are not only means of part of it, but our emotions, how we act, and it's the dynamic. And actually, our brain is picking up on the right side of the brain for these giant patterns, not only the micromomentaries in the face, but it's also how we speak. If we stutter, I know upstate New York, if I stutter just once, I can talk all day. But the moment I start stuttering or I stop to think, they know that I'm thinking. That makes them immediately uncomfortable. And what happens, then you charge in, you stop what you're saying, and they use an emotion frame. Not so much as an anchor. Physical gestures are an anchor one way, but it's the emotional ones. There's a political term called shark bait. You use a word like liberal, and next thing you know, there's this whole level of emotional context to go through. And once you use those words, you're anchoring it to, it's a bait. And people respond to an emotion. But as soon as they have that emotional frame of mind, program, you'll find that their personality constructs actually will feed the means into their brains just like an operating system, like programming.
know, dump it out. People regurgitate it just like that. Now, once you have people emotionally set up like that, this is how you program it. Those beings go right into it. And all you have to do is trigger someone's emotion. They'll pick up right on it. You'll find people who have that type of charisma, and they'll do it. You know, like even in church, you know, people get into this little pattern, demigod pattern. It's getting people to an emotional frame, their mind's framework. And they just dump the means in. This is my observation. So I have a spiritual deepness where it's like they talk about culture, you know, the thing about life is an illusion. It's not life, it's our perception of it.
Right, it is our perception of it. And what we see is not necessarily the same as how we perceive it. And by trying to understand a person's personality type, you can then better get a look inside their head, because since not everyone sees things the exact same way, if you were trying to use specific phrases or specific tones, you need to know how they're going to react about it. And as he was saying about, talking about the brain patterns, recognizing what you see. That is something that also, to some degree, happens in everybody else. If you see, you know, somebody dancing, neurons in your brain do fire off as if you're doing the exact same thing. And as I said, depending on the, there's numbers of things that can go wrong with the brain, where can go to the extreme as that, or synesthesia, where your senses mix over. Not all necessarily negative. If you have a teacher teaching a student something, or a trait, they're not necessarily going to convey all the information that would need to be conveyed, because some stuff they may consciously not think of, that you just take for granted. And so the principle is, by mimicking the person on every level you possibly can, that you're going to subconsciously pick up on the things that they would otherwise not pass over. And it would seem that would be then part of the larger construct that I talked about, like the memes, where we transmit information without actually being consciously aware of it. And if you're not consciously aware of the information you're transmitting, whether it's positive or negative, it may be more than what any person wants to actually give out. The microphone or her, but that's loud.
Case in point, exactly what you're just talking about right now. Everyone that was sitting here that walked out, we were talking, paying attention to the visual. You know, it's energetic, and this lady who can hear up here is shouting at everyone to keep you engaged. They already just got to be what you're saying, obviously, you know, stop those visual cues, and just, if they're not, they just automatically turn off.
Right. Now, of course, I wish I got more sleep. So I'd be a bit more animated, but 3 days.
Another neurolinguistic programming thing that is always kind of cool is like learning to speak in E-prime when you try to say a statement, removing any reference to the word is, which is like what you were saying before about finding something as this is a liberal idea or this is something. Reduces everything to one singularity where you can only see it in one way, and that causes all this conflict, like little talking heads on the news all the time, it has to be one way or the other. But like when you're having an argument with someone, if you can take that isness out and say, like, take an example, like, Susie, where's Susie's work? Susie is professional. Susie goes out at night, Susie dances and goes crazy. You meet two people that know her in different aspects, and you'll be like, Susie's great at work, and the other person says, Susie's a whore. And then you have a collaboration, right? Because both can be true at different times, and that's completely a perceptual thing. And you need to, if you can teach yourself to take that out and see things, see the
Right, and talking about the fact that all of those arguments that could come from that, it kind of goes back to what I was saying, how this, to me, seems to be very important, that there's, first of all, at the face value of what I was talking about, being able to exploit people, that's, one, can be dangerous, and two, people need to do more research to and explore this to learn how to protect themselves and do whatever they want with it. And also, on the other fact of the matter is, a lot of the problems that we have in this world are because of misunderstandings. If we took more time to understand how each other work, we may not have as many of them.
You mentioned more research on
brain
activity. Right.
Darren Brown is definitely entertaining. I've watched some of the shows. But there's a number of resources you can find, but you have to really scour extremely hard. Now, something I wanted to have done before I came to speak was I was going to have a list of resources that I had found, because I generally don't just want to say that I've made up everything or so on. I want to actually have as much facts behind what I've said as possible, and it'll also help people who want to look into this to see, to decide for themselves whether it's something they want to look into or not, to actually put that together, because right now it's very difficult.
Do you have a website or somewhere you can first pay
for? Right now what I was going to do is I have a, on Gmail, I was going to put a set of links on Google Pages. If anyone wants to email me or they know the account to find the Google Pages, if you know about that, is dot.ret@gmail. And yeah, it's the same thing that's on the schedule, second speaker. Someone over here have a question?
What about the future possibilities of brain hacking in similar ways to the brain machine? Audio visual and similar in concept in the same way that the known issue of people seeing a certain image or color patterns and almost in a video memory marker on the photograph issue will see before possibly physical other muscles or other areas.
Right, and sometimes that is actually literally a buffer overflow where flashing lights can give some people seizures. And
the possibility of what we're trying to figure out, such as how to put somebody in a police station, say if they accidentally override the tree, people are agreeing.
Right.
And you can't figure out how to turn that on. There are good side effects that might be able to come up with, such as forcing somebody to stay where you are physically, without using caffeine, as well as your hand accidentally override the critical areas of the process.
Well, in my opinion, no matter how dangerous something may be, it's always better to look into it, understand it as thoroughly as possible, so that way you can avoid those dangers from there on.
Right.
And like as you talked about with the brain machines and the audiovisual stimulation, that a lot of that doesn't necessarily seem to make sense. Like, why would that happen? And you know, there is also a lot of research we need to do on the brain. But one thing I mentioned earlier was the brain is structures built on top of structures, and the ones before weren't really completely designed for the ones that come thereafter. And you have just sort of a, in some ways, you could say it's a patchwork system. And with all these extra things put together, the effects that result aren't always what one would consider positive, which can cause the brain, for instance, in that particular case, to be exploited where you can possibly get yourself into a hallucinated state.
Although, even though it's kind of more science fiction than the present,
right,
the possibility of figuring out
well, another area may be opening up with that with the brain implants, which would actually really bring the term brain hacking to an entire new level, because if you had wireless connection to your brain, people could try downloading viruses and so on.
They're actually, DARPA was working. telekinetic looking. And if you're a U.S. citizen, your tax dollars went to fund a research project where they did exactly that. They took the motor cortex of the monkey and implanted electrodes into it. And the monkey was, and the antenna, the monkey was able to move a robotic arm in its lab. And that was 2004. It's now 4 more years later. So technology has probably progressed a lot just as Moore's Law states. So expect a lot of that stuff in the future. Right now it's the motor cortex, so it's probably more of that physical barrier. What they're hoping for is the people who are quadriplegics who can't move any of their body will be able to hack around the spine and give them mobility again. But again, that's in the future, that hasn't actually been done yet. So as far as interfaces of electronic components and wetware, as it's called, for the brain, it'll probably be that first, but probably within most of our lifetime, we'll see a lot of that. I'm not an expert on this, but I've done hypnosis for about 2 years now. If you don't want to learn like a huge big system, a good starter thing to get is a book called How to Change Anybody. I forget the author, it's called How to Change Anybody. And in it, he has very specific examples of social manipulation that he's done for specific things, for friends, for loved ones, for family, for kids. To get somebody to believe a certain thing, to not believe a certain thing, to do something, not do something. What we've learned about the brain is that as far as what affects your happiness, it's what you're thinking, and not even that far back. Generally, your level of happiness is determined by how you feel about the events of the last 3 months of your life. They've taken people who have been in horrible car accidents and people who have won the lottery. Rate your level of happiness from 1 to 10 right after it happened. Of course, people who just won the lottery were very, very happy, and those that had been in car accidents were not very happy at all. A year later, they called the same people, and as far as the differences in happiness levels, they were negligible. So a year later, it does not affect your happiness. So over a longer period of time, if you do little things like that to someone over a longer period of time, again, the threshold is 3 months. So that's really all it takes. If you get 3 months past an event, it only affects you.
Right, and someone had a question?
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how these inherent vulnerabilities that can be exploited in our subconscious are utilized by public relations companies. If you maybe could talk a little bit about the work of Edward L. Bernays.
I know that in the public sector, they definitely do try to, depending on who it is you're talking about, would probably try to use various methods to get their viewers to either believe what it is they want or tune in next time. But I'm not exactly the biggest news person, so I really can't go in too much into that, unfortunately.
I just have one other point. It's just something I found recently. The work of Professor Michael Persinger, who I forget which university he's at, but it's at University of Canada. He's done work with using electromagnetic pulses that mimic the resonance of chemicals in the brain, and actually just through electromagnetism can recreate the effect of certain drugs in the brain.
Well, yes, yeah, since our brain is basically a computer, and it is an electrochemical computer, it is physically vulnerable to using systems like that. I was going to go on with something else for a while, so if you want to say something now, I'll be fine.
I just wanted to say something more about Persinger. He's at Laurentian University. And he's got this thing called the God Helmet, and what it does is apparently it induces the feeling that you're in contact with God. And I mean, there's also on the X-Files as well, so you may remember that show a long time.
That does remind me of certain chemicals which if you come back to with the hardware hacking, like, you know, DMT, a lot of people have claimed they've experienced beings and so on.
Yeah, there's a
you apply a strong electromagnetic field to this part of your head for your parietal lobes. It stimulates the emotions, and you get the, you call it an epinoic event, where you can see God, you can see anything. It's a very large emotional event. It causes, opens up the mind to be either hyper-suggestible or to fill in the vacuum of your own cultural preferences. You have physical phenomena like ionized gases, which can have from fault lines and what have you, that actually creates large potentials. You get people who see God at rifts and caves and whatnot, where these physical phenomena are likely to happen.
Right, and that brings up an interesting thing, because those kinds of chemicals don't always have the same effect on everybody. Some people would have a very spiritual encounter, and other people would have a very bad one. And
point taken, the 750 observers at the Vatican, only two had religious experiences. Everybody else just saw light.
Right, and I forget what the, there was some people talking about that they believed that a specific gene, I forget which one the designation was, that people who had it were more likely to be religious or not. And whether that's true or not, a fact that would remain is that certain people who are more religious would have, again, certain personality types. And that actually is very important to understand, to pay attention to how someone acts, what it is they're giving off, because being that our perception is so different, that not everyone perceives things the same way depending on what your personality type is, you could equate that for anyone who's had experience with web design, it'd be the equivalent of an interpreted language or HTML, like JavaScript. You know, that thing is every browser supports in a completely different way. And you need to understand specifically how each one works if you want to be able to make it run properly in that one. And the idea, and when you put ideas in different people's heads, it kind of works the same way.
You mentioned memetics and memes, and some of the stuff about PR also brought this to mind. There have been a lot of sort of anthropological and cognitive science studies, or at least emerging, about the effectiveness of certain ritual acts in religion, and I was wondering if you wanted to comment on how, you know, there are certain effective patterns of transmission of ideas in massive religious structures and also in very small religious structures.
Well, I wouldn't comment specifically on religion, but I would say that there probably are patterns which are more effective than other patterns, because if these are things that are designed, evolutionarily speaking, then you kind of would want a somewhat standardized protocol for information to be transmitted across, and organizations who maybe learned how to use that properly would have an easier time than others.
You mentioned how misunderstandings are the cause of most of the conflicts in the world, and do you think that getting the information out there about our interactions and the subtler levels of things that people don't usually notice, do you feel that like disseminating this knowledge, how do you see that? How do you see that affecting like society as a whole?
Well, you can always point to certain negative things coming from anything that you go and try and do. But as I said before, in my opinion, if you want to eliminate the possible negatives that can come out of that area, you should explore it till it's fully understood, and then you can do your best to prevent those issues, whatever they may be. And also, this is also a matter of information and knowledge. And I don't think that dangers which may possibly happen can outweigh the quest for knowledge and the benefits that you can get from it.
So a couple people have mentioned a couple of things that actually there are like more recent updates for. So in terms of the monkey brain thing, they've actually gotten the okay to start working with human research. And then the gentleman commented about religious studies. There actually is some work that was done on religious environments And there's actually a book online that people can read called The Battle for Your Mind by a guy named Dick Sutton. And he actually talks about his research as well as, he's a hypnotist, he talks about his research as well as someone else's research in dealing with religious ceremony and how that puts people in a certain state of mind and certain things that are done in religious ceremony to invoke certain states of consciousness. So a lot of these things are all talked about in MIT has a cognitive science journal, and it's a monthly journal, and it's really good that deals with like all the things that we're talking about right now.
What's the name of that journal?
Subliminal, are you ever in a store or listening to something and you say, they're hitting me with some subliminal message and how you can resist that?
I didn't completely hear everything you said.
I'll say it a little louder. Are you ever in a store or listening to something and you say, they're hitting me with subliminal messaging and how you can resist that?
Well, if you understand what it is that's the method, if you're in a store and you hear music playing and you think that it is some form of subliminal messaging, simply understanding and realizing that will do a world of benefit for protecting you from that. It's kind of like knowing the name of the beast gives you power over it.
I think once you realize it's subliminal.
Right, and part of the thing about that is that the conscious mind basically serves as a protection for the layers underneath. And if you're aware of it, you can take proper measures to block it out. Now, our minds don't work exactly like computers, and we can't have perfect firewalls running, the exact same way all the time. Our minds, our focus goes in and out and so on and so forth. But still, simply by being aware of it, you would actually decrease its effectiveness. That question, unfortunately, that would take a very detailed conversation, I think, and that's probably a situation where you want to see the child you're talking about to actually make sure that, like we spoke about before with modeling, a teacher may not necessarily, not intentionally, but unconsciously not transmit all the information that may be helpful. And being that I wouldn't want to call myself an expert, I wouldn't want to answer that. And you had a question? What? I'm having a hard time hearing what you're saying. I'm not completely familiar with Well, we did speak about that earlier, and that mainly was just talking about it doesn't all completely make sense, but rather the fact that the brain is layer upon layer of newer structure on top of older ones, that with all these extra systems running in between, it's kind of hard to say whether that's intentional or not. For instance, there's actually, you don't see in just one part of your brain, you actually have seen two different parts of your brain. And people who've had the frontal part and the cerebral damage where they couldn't consciously see the parts further back, they weren't consciously aware that they were able to see, but if they were asked to grab something on the table, 9 times out of 10, they would grab it. And it just brings about the thing that, the fact that there are many systems running which don't necessarily help each other by running together.
I have a related question about brain training as well.
Okay.
In your magazine, when you talk and gives these questions for cringe, he explains the theory of magic by saying, among other things, that certain patterns of sound and light will correspondence in the United States. And I was curious if you knew how strong this correspondence was on the justification for that number.
Well, I've heard different numbers, and so it does depend on who you talk to. Sometimes people will say 10% are, you know, are all that will be affected. Other times they say 20, sometimes they say a third. Again, I would say that that comes down to you know, personality types, and being that the mind is so, is in the brain, understanding that would then give you an understanding to the brain, and then possibly you could tailor it so it would work a large percentage of the time.
I think a good example of a pattern of light that can affect people, and you can try this on yourself to see if it affects you, is but somehow try and find a pattern of light that looks like a pair of boobs, and see how that affects you, and think about how that might affect your friends and how many people around you that might affect. I don't know. Because, like, there's a lot of pictures of boobs online.
And that actually does bring up an interesting point, that when we look at things, inanimate things, like, say, clouds, we look for patterns in things. We see shapes that aren't really there. And by the fact that our mind does that, we are be influenced by, just lost to say. You can be influenced by things in a number of ways that... I'm really sleeping. Like, you're talking about light patterns. These lights are, like, blinding me right now. I don't know why they have them shining in my face. let's see. We have time for, like, a couple more questions. So, if anyone else.
I think at the same time, when you bring up flashing lights and such, it also brings to light epilepsy.
Right.
Seizures from flashing lights doesn't affect everyone. But at the same time, it does kind of exclude a certain group. And that also kind of proves that, you know, flashing lights and what comes at you doesn't affect everyone the same way. And that kind of brings about, I guess, the massive diversity within the human mind.
Right. And what's also interesting is that I wouldn't say necessarily the epileptic traits from flashing lights, you know, bringing up those. But a lot of other qualities that we have, which you could consider malfunctions in the mind, in the wild, may have had a negative effect, and natural selection may have cleaned some of them out. But being the society we're in now, and how we try to help as many people as possible, we could actually be throwing off those ratios, making it much harder to predict. I thought I saw someone raising a hand over there.
So earlier in your talk, you were talking about when you're talking to people regarding varying personality types and keeping up on particular personality characteristics. Could you go into a little bit more detail regarding what characteristics you're picking up and different categories of personality that you're looking for?
I would love to, but unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I'll try to put stuff online or see what I can do about that. But I have to say that it's happy to see how many people were asking questions and even commenting on each other's questions. Because to me, this seems like a very important thing. And for the reason of understanding how this can be used against you, and the reason of how this could possibly be used to just better our interactions with other people, it's something that shouldn't be ignored, and people should go out there, do research, and don't have to take my word for it. Do research and see if you think it's believable or not, and if so, decide whether you want to explore that. You know, this is a hackathon. I would expect people to, look for themselves and not just listen. So thank you for putting up with my really...
Actually, there's a couple different
network intrusion
thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've never done it before, but it was awesome. Yeah. It's like this new support that they just
picked up. And it's like a monthly chart, it's just all things.
I run an organization called Sensory Research, and so I do sensory research and then do audio VR. So like right now, I brought my VR glove and we'll be demonstrating some stuff sometimes. Using the VR glove to navigate VR scenes and then software that allows me to do using VR audio and video. You know what? I just gave out my last one to that gentleman there. But are you here?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Okay, I'm going to print up some more. So I'll definitely
That's awesome. Thank you.